everyone, and welcome to NEBBY, the podcast about Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes. I'm your host, April Johnston. This episode was supposed to come out in March. Unfortunately, I ran into some production trouble. But the upshot is, you get two episodes of NEBBY in April. You're welcome. Since I've kept you waiting, let's get right to the story. Fourteen years ago, when I was a reporter at the Beaver County Times, my fabulous editor, Lori DeLauder, asked me to pen a series about Dixmont State Hospital. At the time, the mental institution had been closed for 2 decades, and a battle had been waged over the 407-acre property located along Ohio River Boulevard in Kilbuck Township. Walmart had plans to build a supercenter on the site, and township residents were fighting it hard. Like so many who grew up in Pittsburgh's northern suburbs, I was fascinated by Dixmont. So, for several days in the spring of 2004, photographer Brian McDermott and I hiked up the hill to the abandoned site. Only 10 of the hospital's 30 buildings remained, and most of those were bolted shut. But others were wide open to the elements, including the once stately Reed Hall, where most of Dixmont's patients had lived. Brian and I skirted around a decomposing deer carcass and the charred remains of a 1995 fire and entered the building. Green paint peeled from the walls in narrow strips. Naked bed frames stood in otherwise barren rooms. Dirt and debris littered the hallways. Spray paint and empty beer cans marked the spots where other explorers had been. Standing in the midst of that mess, it was difficult to fathom mentally ill patients living and thriving there. But for decades in the early 20th century, that's exactly what they did. No story of Dixmont can be told without first introducing Dorothea Dix. Dix was born on April 4, 1802, in Maine, and grew up in Massachusetts. Though she often wasn't well, some have said she suffered from depression, Dix operated 2 different schools in Boston before departing for Europe in the mid-1830s. It was there that she encountered a group of reformers fighting for the rights of the mentally ill. She returned to the U.S. in 1840, inspired to fight for similar change. She began that fight in her home state. The mentally ill in Massachusetts relied on an unregulated and underfunded network of state caregivers. Though it may have been a good system in theory, when she went looking, Dix found widespread abuse. Some patients were locked in pens. Others were beaten. Soon after Dix made her findings public, legislators passed a bill to expand the state's mental hospital so patients could receive care in a more reliable environment. After that victory, Dix was hooked. She began investigations in other states, including New Jersey, Illinois, and North Carolina. Most of that work resulted in more reforms. Dix once told a biographer that a successful crusader had to be at once a voice of tender supplication for the outcasts of the earth and their impassioned champion, capable of flaming with sacred fire. Dix was certainly that. By the time she arrived in Pennsylvania, she'd been studying the plight of the mentally ill and fanning that fire for nearly a decade. Still, what she found here shocked her. In February 1845, she offered a scathing address to Pennsylvania legislators, describing the state of the Allegheny County Jail, where many of the mentally ill were then housed. "The Allegheny County Jail at Pittsburgh combines all the faults and abuses of the worst county prisons in this state or in the United States. Here, the sick were unattended, the ignorant untaught, the repentant, if any, unencouraged, and the insane, forgotten." Her concerns were partially addressed when the Western Pennsylvania Hospital was established in 1848, helping the plight of the mentally ill a bit by offering some services and accommodations. But it wasn't until 1855 that the state legislature appropriated funds for what would become the Western Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane at Dixmont. Local advocates, including Dr. Joseph Reed, who would become Dixmont's first superintendent, originally chose a spot in Homestead on which to build the hospital. Dix disapproved. She had been brought on as a consultant, and she envisioned something greener and more idyllic. She found it at Blackstone Farm, which sat on a hill overlooking the Ohio River, 12 miles north of Pittsburgh. On a stifling 88-degree day in July 1859, 200 people took the 20-minute train ride from Pittsburgh to Blackstone Farm for the laying of the hospital's cornerstone. In a cut in that cornerstone, they placed a glass jar and filled it with the artifacts of the day. A letter from Dorothea Dix, all the Pittsburgh daily newspapers, a list of the state legislators, and two copies of The Olden Time by Pittsburgh journalist and historian Neville B. Craig. Dixmont was built over the next 4 years following what's known as the Kirkbride Plan. Dr. Thomas Kirkbride is considered one of the founding fathers of American psychiatry, so he had strong views on how buildings and grounds for the mentally ill should be constructed and maintained. He required rambling Victorian structures, where the center housed administrative offices and two wings fanned out on either side, one for male patients and one for female patients. The arrangement allowed for sunshine and fresh breezes for all, and easy construction should the wings ever need to be expanded. Move-in day was November 11th, 1862. 113 patients left the 12th Ward of West Penn and boarded a special train of cars furnished by the Pittsburgh, Fort Wayne, and Chicago Railroad. One doctor observed, "There was no noise, excitement, or attempts at escape. On the contrary, the patients enjoyed the ride, expressed much interest in their new home, and labored diligently to place their new quarters in order." Though just 113 patients opened Dixmont, the population soon exploded. Superintendent Reed had predicted this in a report he wrote back in 1855, suggesting that 1,200 people were in need of psychiatric care in the region, and only about 200 were receiving it. Now, there was a place to go, and before the new century dawned, more than 1,000 sought treatment there, though some of their afflictions would probably not result in hospitalization today. Disappointment, jealousy, menopause. In the early years, Dixmont also agreed to house Civil War soldiers in need of care or a place to recuperate. Upon his death, one of those soldiers was buried on the Dixmont grounds in a cemetery that, although unkempt, still exists today. All of this growth prompted Reed to push for a purchase that would define the hospital's mission and its relationship to its patients for years to come. In 1870, Reed oversaw the acquisition of an adjoining plot of land, more than doubling the hospital's acreage. The space allowed for a hennery and a herd of dairy cows, for the planting of fruit trees and vegetable gardens. Everything that was raised and grown ended up on patients' plates, or was sold to the public with proceeds returning to the hospital. In time, Dixmont became completely self-sufficient. And it wasn't just the food. The hospital had its own post office and train station. Natural springs provided water. The stone used in its construction was mined on the property. Even the Christmas trees were homegrown. That autonomy only intensified when Joseph Reed died and Dr. Henry Hutchison became Dixmont's second superintendent in 1885. In 1861, at the advent of the Civil War, the Union Army named Dorothea Dix Superintendent of Army Nurses. It wasn't a good fit. The qualities that made Dix an effective advocate also made her a terrible manager of people. She was stubborn and single-minded, zealous and outspoken. She came up with strategies for change, but she had trouble implementing them. Eventually, she resigned. Henry Hutchison shared Dix's passion for the reforms, but he took the opposite approach. Hutchison, according to oral histories housed in the Heinz History Center archives, was a tall, slim, and quiet man who favored dark suits and took deliberate steps, always walking slowly with his hands folded behind his back. He lived on the second floor of Reed Hall with his wife, and though their quarters were completely divided from the rest of the building, he fully immersed himself in the inner workings of the hospital. He was known for conducting inspections from aboard a carriage, pulled by his horse, Rosie, leaving notes of personal thanks when he saw something that pleased him, and notes asking for changes when he saw something that didn't. Hutchison had served as a staff doctor for 5 years before taking over as superintendent, so it's not surprising that he absorbed Reed's lessons in self-sufficiency and then took them a step further. In 1907, the hospital split from the Western Pennsylvania system to operate independently as Dixmont Hospital for the Insane. The divorce was a quick one, made possible by Hutchison's firm belief in work therapy. Every patient who was able took a job on the hospital grounds, tending to the animals on the farm, picking cherries, plums, and apples from the orchard, pushing carts back and forth to the laundry, and waiting tables in the doctor's formal dining room. Eventually, the hospital added 2 annex buildings, housing patients who worked on the more remote parts of the property and who could be trusted to live apart from administrators. Patients received compensation for their work in the form of semi-annual celebrations, which Hutchison always kicked off by dancing with a patient, and in small paychecks. Many spent their earnings in Herbert Sloan's canteen, located in the dietary building next to Reed Hall. Sloan was a longtime patient at Dixmont, and a high-functioning one. That afforded him certain privileges and freedom. Once a week, he traveled to Bellevue or to Pittsburgh by streetcar to restock his shelves with candy, Coca-Cola, and cigarettes. Less entrepreneurial patients still managed to earn a bit of money. They gathered in a second-floor occupational therapy room in Reed Hall to crochet hats and socks, or to paint, and staff would eventually offer their work to the public. One patient sold a hand-hooked rug to a Swickley socialite for $150. When patients weren't working, they had a picturesque landscape to enjoy, with wide swaths of green grass, interrupted only by gardens, goldfish ponds, and trellises of flowering vines. Still, for some, Dixmont was more like a prison than a retreat. Patients ended up at Dixmont because they had tried everything else first, and everything else hadn't worked. It was a last resort, the final hope in a world of hopelessness. A woman named Lublow was one of those patients. Lublow was born in Poland in 1912 and lived a fairly uneventful life until the 1939 invasion. The Germans crossed Poland's western border on September 1st, the Russians the eastern border on September 17th. It was the Russians who cornered Lublow first and sent her off to Ukraine to work in a coal mine. She tolerated that existence for 3 months before convincing a coal train operator to help her escape. She hid in a coal cart and rode the train into Kiev, where she was promptly apprehended by another group of Russian soldiers. This time, they allowed her to continue on to a contested region tucked between Poland and Ukraine. She settled down there, married a man, and operated a grocery store, until the Russians confronted her for a third time. She and her husband immediately fled to Austria and quietly worked on a farm until the American army liberated them in 1945. They emigrated to the United States shortly thereafter and hoped that move would put an end to the chaos. But in 1952, Lublow started experiencing what her doctors labeled extreme agitation. They sent her to Dixmont and suggested she be placed in seclusion. For months, she sat alone in her room and pulled at her clothing, unraveling her shirts and her pants, thread by thread. Maybe to combat the loneliness, or to hang on to whatever pieces of her life she still recognized, Lublow used those threads to make a family of tiny dolls, delicately weaving and tying each strand into place. Lublow's story had a happy ending. She was freed from her seclusion and eventually released from Dixmont. Not everyone was so lucky. One patient penned this letter to his wife in 1921. "Dear wife, I think you have forgotten me now. Charlotte, if you will write Dr. Hutchison a letter, I think he will let me come home. I'm tired of this place, and I want to come home. I feel good now. This man I was telling you about is coming soon, and he will fix us all up if we need to be. So try and let me come home. Soon as possible. Yours, C.D. Carson." He wasn't the only patient desperate for his release. Admissions far outnumbered releases in the early 1900s, some years by a margin of more than 50 to 1. By the 1930s, the population swelled to nearly 1,500 patients, stretching the limits of the hospital's infrastructure. It was thanks in part to the mental scars World War I left on soldiers, but in even larger part, to the Depression. People arrived at Dixmont, mentally ill or not, hoping for food and a place to stay for a while. Hutchison ordered cots be brought in and lined up in the hallways. Those he couldn't accommodate at least got a sandwich from the dining hall. For a while, money was so tight that employees, who typically lived on site, were forced to work for room, board, and laundry. No paycheck. The hospital never fully recovered from the financial stress of the Depression. And in 1945, after 65 years at the helm, Dr. Henry Hutchison died. The 1-2 punch was too much for Dixmont. In 1946, the state stepped in and took it over. Once the state arrived, chaos came fast to a place that for decades had run on the orders and opinions of one man. The hospital immediately got a new name, Dixmont State Hospital, and a new superintendent who cultivated a different kind of culture, one where patients were patients. Work therapy fell from favor. Herbert Sloan lost his store. The farm animals were, well, put out to pasture. But the biggest shift was the one that has come to define not just Dixmont, but all mental hospitals of that era: experimental treatments. In the 1940s and 50s, Dixmont doctors performed irreversible surgeries and offered controversial therapies, whose side effects were sometimes as bad as the original illness. Lobotomies, the removal of the prefrontal cortex, or at least the scraping away of any connections to the rest of the brain. They happened there. Electroshock therapy, too, where patients were strapped to beds while electricity charged through their bodies and produced bone-shaking seizures. Today, lobotomies and shock therapy are viewed as archaic, even cruel, except as a last line of intervention in the worst cases. Back then, they were considered revolutionary. That is, until the true revolution happened. Medication, especially the antipsychotic drug Thorazine, changed everything. Symptoms once considered unmanageable were managed. Patients who expected to die at Dixmont were suddenly ready to be released into the world. By the 1970s, releases, which had once been so rare, outpaced admissions. And mental health advocates began to rethink the practicality and the morality of mental institutions. It had been more than 100 years since Dorothea Dix began her campaign, 80 since her death. She couldn't have imagined the medical advances and shifting attitudes, or the questions the new wave of advocates would ask themselves. Were patients truly better off living wholly apart from the community, even if that community came with a sweeping view of the Ohio River? Did that kind of seclusion offer security or force dependency? Were institutions a benevolent solution for communities who didn't know any other way to care for their ill? Or were they convenient wells for their apathy? The answers to those questions were furiously debated over many years, but most advocates eventually came to the same conclusion. Patients should be a part of the community, not apart from the community. Some tried to fight the shift. The Beaver County Commissioners signed a proclamation in 1972, calling Dixmont an invaluable asset to the community. They were trying to stave off what seemed to be the hospital's inevitable closure. A handful of patients who had been released or moved to group homes returned to the hospital and begged to be readmitted. "There's more to do here," one man explained it. Ultimately, it was the state's budgetary cuts that ended the debate. Pennsylvania couldn't afford to dump any more money into the hospital. In 1984, the last 177 patients were discharged or transferred, and Dixmont's doors closed forever. On June 7th, 1995, the calls started pouring into 911. Dixmont was on fire. Engines from 14 different companies roared up the hill to find the center of Reed Hall, where Dr. and Mrs. Hutchison once served four-course meals on hand-painted china, engulfed in orange flames. It took hours to get the fire under control. Only a handful of the property's fire hydrants worked anymore. The property had been abandoned, subject to vandals and exposure, for 11 years. Occasionally, a developer would draw up a plan for the site, a retirement community, a county jail, but nothing stuck. There were too many zoning issues and utility problems. Meanwhile, windows cracked, building basements flooded. The longer it sat unused, the less appealing Dixmont became. But the fire? Well, that settled it. No one was going to buy Dixmont with its most iconic building beyond repair. No one, that is, except Ralph Stroney. The fire forced the state to lower its asking price from several million dollars to $750,000. That was right in Stroney's budget. Stroney, his wife Carol, and son Tim bought Dixmont in 1999. It's adjacent to their 30-acre farm, so it made sense to have a say in who, or what, became their neighbors. It was a funny situation for Tim, who had grown up riding ATVs on the property, exploring the old buildings, and throwing parties inside, to suddenly become its protector. The family installed security cameras in the remaining buildings. Tim watched the monitors during the day, and after the sunset, snuck up on late-night explorers, laughing when they ran off screaming. Ralph, too, had a bit of fun with trespassers, leaving lit candles in the fourth-floor windows of Reed Hall. It was a wink to those who believed that Dixmont was haunted by the ghosts of departed patients. Do a Google video search for Dixmont State Hospital, and you'll get dozens of hits. Most amateur ghost hunters spending the night in Reed Hall or exploring the system of tunnels that ran beneath the property, connecting many of the buildings. They trade stories of horror, like the patient who froze to death in an escape attempt, and the patient who attacked a supervisor with a pitchfork. Both are true, by the way. But the most prolific of the ghost hunters was likely a man named Marty Patterson. He descended on Dixmont dozens of times over the years with his ghost hunting group, Raw Fear. They always had Stroney family permission. Patterson's pure fascination with the place was infectious and kind of comical. One moment, he's swearing to have seen the ghost of a woman who drowned in a bathtub in Reed Hall. The next minute, he's hanging out of a first-floor window, trying to rig an office light bulb to a generator, just to see if it's possible to get it going. Turns out, it was. Later, he lit up an entire floor. "People on Neville Island are really gonna be freaked out," he told me then. But Patterson's playground didn't last. The Stroneys sold the 75 acres closest to Ohio River Boulevard to ASC developers in 2005. ASC planned to replace the old hospital with a 240,000 square foot Walmart supercenter. It was not an easy sell. Communities First was a group of 400 citizens from 9 towns along the Ohio River, and they fought the construction for years, mostly citing traffic concerns and redundancy. Who needs a Walmart when there's a Target a few miles away? They were successful in getting the project delayed, but not in stopping it. ASC secured the permits it needed, and in 2006, demolished what was left of Dixmont, including Reed Hall. On September 19th, 2006, as the company was grading the land for construction, the hillside gave way, and 500,000 cubic feet of earth tumbled onto the road below. It was one of the largest landslides the region has ever experienced, and it was a traffic and public relations disaster. Ohio River Boulevard, a main artery between the city and the Beaver Valley, was closed for weeks. And Walmart, which had already been embroiled in that bitter fight with township residents, was left with a lot of explaining to do. Dirt and debris continued to creep down the hillside for several years after that initial disaster. And eventually, the landslide did what Communities First wasn't able to. It stopped Walmart. The company abandoned plans for construction. But it didn't abandon Kilbuck Township. Walmart spent a reported $60 million to stabilize the land and plant 7,000 oak, maple, and pine trees. Unless you know, it's already nearly impossible to tell where Dixmont once stood. It's all green and idyllic now, just a vast plot of land overlooking the Ohio River. Just like in the 1850s, when Dorothea Dix deemed it the perfect place to rest and find a cure for all that ails us. Thanks for listening to Nebby. This episode was researched, written, and produced by me, April Johnston, with a lot of production help from David Smith. If you want more information on the music and research used in this episode, check the show notes or head to the website, nebbypittsburgh.com. If you haven't rated or reviewed Nebby on Apple Podcasts, please consider it. It helps other people find the show. And in case you haven't heard, Nebby is now available on Stitcher. That's it for now. But join me later this month when Nebby returns with more stories of Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes. See you soon.